The following Dharma talk was recorded in St. Louis, Missouri in August 2012 at a retreat sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. More talks from their retreats can be found at www.midamericadharma.org. The speaker is Shyla Catherine, founding teacher of Insight Meditation South Bay in California. More teachings and information about her work can be found at www.imsb.org.
So I'd like to speak tonight about simplicity. Some of you may have seen a book, it was a biography of an Indian saint named Ramana Maharshi, and the title was Be As You Are. And the book is quite good, but I really like the title, because the title itself is a profound teaching. Can we be as we are? We already are as we are. We're not any other way. And yet, sometimes we're not aware of what actually is happening now. We're not aware of being as we are. Sometimes we crave more, we want something else. We think what's happening now is not good enough. It's not good enough to bother to pay attention to. And so we zone out, we space out, we fantasize, we think, we daydream, we plan, we remember, we ruminate. We do many things other than just notice what's happening now. We're sitting, we're breathing, we're ruminating, we're thinking. This is what's happening. What do we need to do? What do we need to realize or know to be free? What is our meditation practice oriented toward? Sometimes we make this practice so very complicated. We complicate it with our expectations, our desires, our fears, our hopes. We sometimes demand a great deal from the experience of sitting and being present. I spent several years living in India and staying with a master by the name of H.W.L. Punja. And it was a marvelous experience learning from him, studying with him. But his teaching was very simple. It didn't require academic study. He would often say, just keep quiet. Do nothing. Don't think. Just keep quiet. And I found this instruction to be tremendously useful and very powerful in the development of my practice. To be that simple. What is a profound quiet? It doesn't mean to just shut up and not speak. It doesn't mean to push the mind into states of contrived calm. There is a depth of quietness, a depth of silence that is undisturbed by sound. I also spent a few years practicing with some Tibetan teachers, and they taught not meditation so much, they taught what they called non-meditation. And the instruction was primarily to do nothing with perfect alertness. Awakeness, clarity. So again, it was a non-striving kind of approach that still required a profound presence with what actually is. But the core of my practice has always been and continues to be mindfulness practice. And I love the simplicity of the mindfulness practice. We're doing something, true. I just gave some meditation instructions. But they weren't really very complicated, were they? They're so simple. Know what is happening. Be present for what is. Cultivate a wakefulness, an awareness, a sensitivity to what is actually occurring. In every moment that we're conscious, we are conscious of something. There is an object to consciousness. Somebody might say, oh no, in a moment, sometimes the mind is empty and spacious. Well, in that moment, we might be conscious of emptiness and spaciousness. We can notice what it is we're aware of, where our attention is focused, and how are we relating to whatever it is we are aware of. So we bring not only the object into clarity, but we bring the quality of knowing into clarity. We notice how we're relating to what we're experiencing in the present moment. The specific techniques of developing mindfulness are not very complicated. In the morning instructions on this retreat, I'll give you some guidance and some instructions to explore different aspects of the cultivation of mindfulness. We'll observe the body, we'll observe the breath, we'll work with the four postures of sitting, walking, standing, and reclining. We'll look at feelings and thoughts, emotions, and we'll see the arising and passing of all physical and mental phenomena. We'll bring clear awareness to whatever is happening in the environment, whatever impacts our senses. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and thinking are all valid objects for mindfulness. Mindfulness is not complicated or confusing. It's not difficult. Like, you don't have to go to get, say, a university degree in it or a license for practicing mindfulness. There's no certificate exam. You don't have to learn how. It's just, you don't even have to read those. You know, when you get these gadgets and gadgets now, sometimes they don't even give you a manual. And you have to kind of play with it. And in a way, you have to kind of play with your mind a little bit. You have to learn how it works. But honestly, figuring out how to use a smartphone is much harder than watching the breath. Baking muffins is much harder than watching the breath. Doing almost anything is actually harder than watching the breath. But though the instructions are really easy, sometimes it's actually hard to do. Did you find that even in that last sitting, you forgot the instructions halfway through? You might have even forgotten where you were. Completely forgotten where you were sitting, the environment that you were in, lost in some thought about something that you want to do, that you wished you had done, some relationship, imagining, speaking, and saying something. We often live disconnected from our experience, our sensory experience, because we're lost in this world of thought. So we train ourselves in mindfulness, and we train ourselves by bringing our attention again and again. Every time we're lost in thought, we bring it back to the simple experience of sitting, of feeling the body, or of observing the breath. But why is that sometimes challenging to do when it's so easy to explain? You know, you might look at the experience of sitting here and think, you know, we're in a very comfortable place, a very safe place. We had a full dinner. What do we have to complain about? You know, it's pretty nice. It's amazing, though. You might actually find that at some point in this retreat, the mind will complain anyway. It's interesting to watch the tendencies of mind. Sometimes there's fault finding. Sometimes there's it's not good enough. Sometimes it's just a little too quiet in comparison to the stimulus that we're used to in our daily life. And so we say, oh, it's boring here. Maybe I'll just fantasize a little bit. I was attending a personal retreat a couple of years ago, and I had to go into the office for some reason during office hours, and the person in front of me during office hours had only arrived at the personal retreat center a couple of days before, and he was already checking out. And I heard what he said. I heard him say to the, you know, quite agitated, to the receptionist that, there's nothing to do here. And I couldn't help but smile because we come on retreats to do nothing, to have nothing to do. I mean, what an incredible opportunity to do nothing. So you have very few responsibilities here. You don't even have to remember very much about the schedule. If you were sitting and you wonder what's next, good chance it's walking. If you were walking and you wonder what's next, the good chance it's sitting. If you're hungry and the bell rings, good chance it's a meal time. You don't have to stress yourself with an appointment book to get through this schedule, to get through these days. And so we can be happy here, being simple and doing nothing. Almost nothing. Because sometimes there's something that needs to be done. Not so much getting up and going here and there, but sometimes when we look at the mind, we think, that's a pattern that maybe is not so healthy to indulge in. And so we want to apply some effort to it. Not to abolish it and wipe it out and hate ourselves for having had some nasty thought, but we want to bring some skillful effort to whatever the condition is. Sometimes, though, we latch a hold of the breath and we think, okay, I'm going to do something here in this meditation. And so we start trying to make some special breath happen. This is not a kind of breath meditation that requires any particular kind of breath. Short isn't better than long. Rough isn't better than smooth. The in-breath and the out-breath can be any length. It doesn't matter how you're breathing. Let the body do the breathing. You don't need to control it. It can be gentle. It can be strong. It doesn't matter. We don't have to try to improve the experience of breathing. We simply let the breath be natural and bring our attention to it. Because we're practicing in a community, it should be a silent breath so that we're feeling the breath and not listening to our breath. And that's out of consideration of the other people around you. But basically, we just do what is the most natural and comfortable thing for the body, to breathe naturally, to breathe comfortably. And then we bring our attention to that. How are we experiencing that natural breath? But just as we sometimes try to manipulate the breath, students often try to manipulate other things that happen as we're sitting here. Oh, there's an itch, there's a pain, there's a tingle. How do we deal with that? How can we make it go away? Oh, there's an insight. Oh, there's a pleasant experience. There's a feeling, there's a memory, there's a thought. How can we enhance the pleasant ones, diminish the unpleasant ones? And the habitual mind wants to increase pleasure and decrease pain. It's natural. But it isn't what we do in the meditation. We just sit here, breathing and observing. What is actually happening? If it's painful, we observe it being painful. If it's pleasant, we observe it being pleasant. And if it's neutral, we observe it being neutral. That can be the most challenging, because there's a difference between observing something that's neutral and being bored or disinterested, which is actually an aversive state. There's really nothing fancy that we're going to be doing in this meditation practice, because nothing complicated is needed to be aware of what is already present, to be as we already are. Longchenpa said, enjoying everything, simply leave it as it is and rest your weary mind. But because the human mind rarely rests, centuries of meditators have devised a whole range of methods and techniques that are appropriate for different conditions, different dispositions of people, different temperaments, and different times in our practice, so that we can cultivate the capacity to be present. And when we look at the history of meditation, we'll find that the techniques really haven't changed all that much in thousands of years. Different eras seem to emphasize different techniques. Sometimes we think that we need something perhaps more sophisticated for our technological age, perhaps even more technological. You can buy on the internet various devices to support your meditation, you know, that read your biofeedback and beep if you're going, you know, and cultivate. You can have all sorts of technological supports. But meditation is itself a cultivation of being sensitive to the body, sensitive to the mind, so that we don't need to be hooked up to a machine to feel what's going on within ourselves. We learn to observe, and that is the process of meditation, is learning to observe the subtle dimensions of what is happening now. Some approaches to practice can look very exciting, dramatic, beautiful, and others can look very casual and simple, and some will look more formal, and some will look more relaxed. You'll see different teachers teaching in different styles, and if you practice in other forms of Buddhism, you might go into one form of a temple, a Buddhist temple, and find that it's stark and the altar is very simple, maybe just earth tones or blacks or grays or wood or clean kind of look, streamlined look. And you might go into another kind of temple and see that there's Persian carpets on the ground or Tibetan weavings or tankas and paintings on the walls. Some will have one Buddha image. Some won't have any Buddha images at all, but just a plant or a symbol of nature. And some will have 1,000 Buddha images in little niches all along the walls. There are many different aesthetics and they inspire different people. But this kind of visual dynamic doesn't make it more complicated as a practice. Whether the aesthetic is colorful and ornate, or whether it's very simple, the practice can be simple. The practice can be uncomplicated. We sit, we walk, we stand, we recline, we bend, we stretch, we eat. We go through the day doing very simple activities, noticing our experience. And noticing what our relationship to that experience is. What's happening and how are we reacting to it? What's occurring and is it triggering a reaction of liking, not liking, wanting, fearing? A simple mind, a state of simplicity, is a mind that is not triggered, not pulled in to these habitual reactions of desire and aversion, wanting and not wanting, hope and fear, so that we can rest, clearly knowing what's happening now, not holding on to it, because in the next moment, what's happening now? And then in the next moment, what's happening now? This simplicity seems very rare in our world. Why is it so rare? Usually a sense of self is confirmed and strengthened by our activities. And so we busy ourselves. We want to accomplish things. And then we want to remember what we did and what we're going to do. And we retell ourselves who we are and who we will become. When we're not engaged in all the reinforcements of past and future, this sense of self might seem more tenuous, uncertain. I hope you'll allow that sense of self to float a little bit less rooted, a little bit less held, so that you can look at it and see if it is real. If and what it is. What's it composed of? What's it fueled by? It's not just a matter of being as we are. It's a matter of discovering what we are. And that may not be who we take ourselves to be. Throughout this retreat, you might hear me say and encourage you to relax, to speak of relaxation, release, ease. What do we need to do to relax? I'm so happy to see that you've all come on this retreat, because just by coming on a retreat, you've given yourself some time to unwind, to unplug from all of the communications that fill our lives. You've given yourself a chance to experience a profound relaxation. Everybody needs to relax, but sometimes our culture doesn't teach us healthy ways to relax. Sometimes the consumerism promotes, you know, a kind of weekend warrior kind of engagement or very costly activities to relax. Or people turned to drugs or alcohol to try to induce a state of relaxation. A lot of money is spent trying to relax. But this is what we do on a holiday. We come to sit, to breathe. You're not going to get very many photos for your holiday album. But I'm glad you're here. I think it's a wise choice. Most religions have some form of Sabbath, some day of rest. In the Buddhist practice, we do this through periodic retreats. We set aside the busyness of our day, the worldly obligations, and we give ourselves some time to turn inward, to find a deep state of rest, to come back into balance, and to cultivate the qualities that we really value, the stability of mind, the wisdom, the clarity, the peace. I often hear people say, I will meditate after I finish this project, or I'll come on a retreat after I've dealt with this personal issue, or I'm going to strengthen my practice just as soon as I solve this problem in my life. We can't postpone our practice. We must wake up here and now. If we put it off, we'll never get there. There'll always be something to intervene. Don't put awakening off to the future. Take the opportunities while you have them. Right now. In the Anguttara Nikaya, the Buddha said, short is the life of human beings, limited and brief. It is full of suffering, full of tribulation. This one should wisely understand. One should do good and live a pure life, for none who is born can escape death. No matter how long we live, even to 100 years, it's brief in the scope of things. How well are we using our time? We can practice now while we have the opportunity, while we find ourselves in such beautiful conditions for practice, in a center that has been dedicated to a spiritual tradition for so, so very long. We don't need to wait for some mythical ideal conditions to occur in our lives. Even when there's suffering, even when there's difficulty, even when it seems like these are terrible conditions, we can even take those as the opportunity for practice. The remainder of this talk, I want to look at a few things that seem to complicate the simplicity of our lives, what I call the extras, the things that become some kind of burden in our life. And the first is to simply consider the material things of our lives. Sometimes we just have too much stuff. Stuff in storage, stuff in the closet, stuff we're responsible for, that we have to take care of. It's a great joy to be simple regarding stuff. When I lived with Poonjiji, we had a 2-burner stove, but only one pot. And I was cooking for 15, 20, 30 people. And I wanted a second pot. I really wanted a second pot. I was perfectly happy to buy a second pot. because I had to cook in rotation. I'd first cook the vegetables and then set it aside and then cook the rice. And if you wanted dal too, it would be like this three-course kind of cooking project. And then the vegetables, of course, would be cold by the... Anyway, I thought a second pot, this would be a good thing. Well, eventually I did buy a second pot, and I gave it to him at a time when he had to accept it. So I got my second pot. But there were many months in between when he kept saying, "We don't need a second pot. We don't need a second pot." And I was really, now in reflection, glad that I could go through that process of realizing that actually we didn't need a second pot. I just wanted one. And so when I finally got one, it wasn't out of this sense, we have to have this, we need it. It was just a sense of, yes, we can have a second pot. And during those years of living with him in India, we didn't have a refrigerator. And there were several years where we did have a refrigerator the last year I was there. But for several years, we didn't have a refrigerator. And people offered to purchase us a refrigerator. And by that time, I was the one saying, "We don't need a refrigerator. What do we need a refrigerator for? You know, we go buy our vegetables and our milk each day, and we cook up what we're going to eat. And when whatever's left over, we give to the pigs outside on the street. Who needs a refrigerator?" Now, I can't imagine living without a refrigerator at home, but it was a wonderful experience to spend some years living much more simply than we do generally. Sometimes we think we need so much. And what do we actually need? To be aware, to be awake, to be kind and compassionate, to be peaceful and wise. I assure you, it is nothing like what we have. We need very little, really very little. What about social stuff? What do we need socially? We certainly don't need all the chit-chat that goes on in our lives. I'm sure everybody has encountered just a little bit more frivolous talk than would be wise in most days of your life. There was one time the Buddha described this in the Udana when he was returning from collecting alms, and he found that a number of monks had gathered in the assembly hall and were speaking about, as the quote says, "Which of these two kings has greater wealth, greater possessions, greater treasury, greater territory, conveyances, army, prosperity, and power?" So basically, they were talking about politics. You know, they were comparing this leader with that leader. And the Buddha was not very impressed with the discussion. He told them that it was not right for someone who had undertaken the holy life, who had undertaken the Dhamma training, to talk on such a subject. He said that when they had gathered together, they should do one of two things: either engage in talk on the noble Dhamma or maintain noble silence. On retreat, this is what we do. When we speak, we're speaking about the Dhamma. We're speaking about our practice. We're exploring the mind. And when we're not speaking. So we let all the social stuff fall away. We let it rest so the mind can grow quiet. I trust that you will enjoy this silent time together. It is a wonderful thing to be sharing a community of silence, to know that we're in community, that we're supporting each other. We can be courteous to each other without interacting in a more direct or personal way. Now, there's also the extra of a lot of mental stuff, the views, the opinions, the beliefs, the proliferations of thought, the stories, the fantasies, the trains of chatter and commentary that goes on in the mind. Often, we don't just observe a thought arising and passing. Often, we're pulled off into a swell of thinking, stories, worries, fretting, reacting, pondering. This circling of the mind around thoughts, triggering more thoughts, triggering more thoughts, triggering emotions and reactions and more thoughts, creates a kind of tension in the mind, and it creates a certain fixed view of who I am, how I think things should be. And when something isn't that way, we can move out in anger and blame. All these projections separate us from an authentic and simple experience of being present with this phenomena that's happening right now. This experience of the body, this experience of the mind. A lot of selfish action is also a great burden in our lives. The five precepts for ethical training protect us because they protect our actions. They keep our actions clean and pure and simple, so that our minds are not complicated by regret and remorse, revenge or fear or worry. So these five ethical precepts include the training to refrain from killing, the training to refrain from stealing or taking what's not been given, the refraining from sexual misconduct. And in the context of a retreat, we are practicing a celibacy, not engaging in sexual actions of any kind. We undertake the training to refrain from false or malicious speech and to refrain from the use of intoxicants that cloud the mind. When our lives are aligned with the precepts, we'll find that we can make decisions and choices in life with a lot less fear, a lot less hesitancy and worry and regret. And it's a great act of simplicity to feel that even though this impulse of greed and wanting arises, we can let it go before we take something that is not ours. Even if a feeling of anger or hate or aggression arises, we can let it go before we act on it. Even if a mosquito comes to bite us because it wants a drop of our blood, we don't habitually just swat it. We might blow it off. We might say, I don't want to share my blood with you today. But we don't act impulsively in a way that harms others. We, in a way, use the precepts to pause between those unhealthy and unwholesome reactions of greed, hate, and delusion before they manifest in action. We take special care with the use of intoxicants because not only do the intoxicants cloud the mind with drugs or alcohol, preventing the clarity that comes through meditation, but they often make it more easy to break the other precepts. When we practice with these precepts, we're not following a commandment that an authority has given us. Instead, we're voluntarily undertaking a training because we sense the wisdom of it, because we want the peace that it leads to, we want the safety that it brings to a community, we value what it develops for ourselves and in community. We're not perfect yet, are you? Maybe, I don't know. I haven't met you all before, so maybe. But for the most part, we're probably not perfect yet. So we might once in a while transgress those precepts or find that the impulses were a little stronger and we forgot what our commitment was. Maybe some false speech slipped out and we didn't realize it until we heard it, some exaggeration or some little lie. It gives us the opportunity to then look squarely at ourselves to see what caused that transgression. It's not like we have to, apologize for every little wrong speech we do. But when we practice with the precepts, we pause, we stop, we think, that transgressed my precept. What was the root of that? That caused the mind to act in a way that I had already made a commitment not to act, to speak or do something in a way that I had not wanted to. So we face our inner demons. We see the roots of greed, hate, and delusion within ourselves. And more and more as we practice with the precepts, we'll find that we'll catch those impulses before they ever come out into action. But there will be times, perhaps, when we catch it in the action first. Take the moment then to not ignore what happened. Take the moment to face what happened. See it. And then recommit to the precept. See the root. Oh, that was rooted in greed. Feel the suffering that's caused by greed. Reflect on it. Not judging ourselves, but just reflect on it and recommit to those precepts. The precept practice is one of the most beautiful practices. I love it. I mean, I really love working with these five precepts. A simple practice, but tremendously valuable, that brings enormous happiness and ease and relaxation in life. The last kind of simplicity is the simplicity of mind that comes when we are not clinging, because clinging is an extra. And it's perhaps the most insidious extra, perhaps the most common thing that we burden ourselves with. Perceptions arise. We see, we hear, we smell, we taste, we touch, we think. But do we burden ourselves with identifying, this is who I am, and I want more of this experience to be mine? Identification and possessiveness burdens ourselves with experience. We don't need to cling to experience. When we're mindful and alert, we experience experience. Fully, wakefully, it comes and it goes. Free from clinging, free from agitation. This may be the ultimate simplicity of being, just being without needing to be me and without needing things to be mine. When we experience the mind without these extras, we will recognize a deep peace of non-reactivity, a silence, a contentment, a profound capacity to let go, to let be. There'll be a clarity to whatever is known. Now, there's a beautiful teaching that the Buddha gave to a recluse by the name of Bahiya, and it's recorded in the Udana, where Bahiya, who's called Bahiya of the bark cloth, because he was a recluse that was living on a seashore, and he clothed himself in bark. Through a series of events, he discovered that although he had previously thought he was fully awakened, he discovered that he was not. fully awakened. And he heard that there was a Buddha, a fully awakened being. And when he heard that there was a Buddha, he immediately wanted to see the Buddha urgently. And he left the seashore and went to, walked in the direction through, and it took quite some time to approach the place where the Buddha was staying in northern India. And when he finally found the Buddha was on alms round. I mean, just this is amazing. I mean, walking so many days to find one man that he had heard existed. And so he found the Buddha in a village on alms round. And as soon as he met the Buddha, he desperately asked for the teachings. And he asked again and again and again until finally the Buddha gave him very brief and pithy instructions, brief teachings right then and there on the village streets. And the Buddha said, "Here in Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In the seen will be merely what is seen. In the heard will be merely what is heard. In the sensed will be merely what is sensed. In the cognized will be merely what is cognized. In this way you should train yourself. When for you in the seen is merely what is seen, and the heard is merely what is heard, in the sensed is merely what is sensed, in the cognized is merely what is cognized, you will not be with that. When you are not with that, then you will not be in that. When you are not in that, then you will be neither here nor beyond, nor in between the two. Just this is the end of suffering." This is a very inspiring teaching to me. So that when we experience something seen, it is just seen. In the heard, there is just what is heard. No extra if I wanted to increase, I wanted to decrease. No judgment or proliferation about where the sound is coming from and what it means. In the sense is merely what is sensed. In the cognized is merely what is cognized. Not taking our thoughts so personally, not building up a sense of self. I am this. This is mine. I'm in this. This is who I am. But we keep it simple. That commitment to simplicity is also a commitment to awakening, to wisdom, to a clarity of perception and conduct that leads to the deepest peace available. We know what is happening. We know what is seen, what is heard, what is sensed, what is cognized. There's mindfulness, there's wakefulness. But we stop short of embellishing it with the concepts and stories of I, me, and mine. We don't burden our experience with the fantasy of who we think we are. We keep it simple, and we just be as we are. We experience this moment as it is, with clarity and full awareness. Let's have a few quiet minutes, please. May all beings come to rest in the grace of this moment. May all beings know profound peace.